Good afternoon. The Public Safety and Budget Division of the Minnesota Senate is called to order. It is Wednesday, February 11th, 2009. Today we're going to continue the budget presentations from the Department of Corrections. I believe we emailed over a list of ideas that we wanted to have a little more discussion on and some more information. And those members are on the agenda, which I believe is in the tucked inside your budget book. And Commissioner Fabian, Assistant Commissioner Chris, Deputy Commissioner Dingle, Assistant Commissioner Cornelius, who'd ever like to come to the table and start? That would be great. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You're getting to feel like, you know, one of the chairs has your name on it permanently?
Permanently, yes.
Go ahead and I know you have the list of items we wanted to have further discussion, so I think I'll just let you drive the discussion and we'll throw in questions as we see them. Would that be all right?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Lisa Cornelius. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Support Services for the Department of Corrections. Joining me this afternoon is Assistant Commissioner David Christ, who works in the Facilities Division. One of the first items brought to our attention was wanting more information on some of the budget cuts we've taken and perhaps even some of the unfunded requests we've had and how that might impact the agency. In the 2002 and 2003 fiscal years, we did take operational cuts, and when I say operational, I mean that directly impacted our agency, not funding that was passed through to the counties. That cut was in the amount of $28.6 million. Most of this was self-imposed, and it was a per diem reduction plan sought out by previous Commissioner Cheryl Ramstead. There were a few other minor operational cuts in all of the divisions. In 2004 and 2005, there were $36.7 million in cuts to the agencies. Some of these were increased tails from the per diem reduction plan, and a lot of them were the operating reductions when the state, again, was in a bad economic times. This is when we attempted to do double bunking, did double bunk. The short-term offender change was made, and we had several cuts also in central office, eliminating over 80 positions. In 2006 and 2007, there were, again, increased tails in the amount of $24.1 million. In this current biennium, we also took a cut of $657,000 for professional technical contracts.
Assistant Commissioner Cornelius, the 2004-2005 budget cuts, the 80 positions that were eliminated, you said some were in central office. Would that be... Could you give us like a proportion of institution versus central office?
Madam Chair, actually all of those 80 positions were in central office.
Okay, thank you.
And if you would like, I can give you some areas where those positions were taken from. Community services, it was the jail resource center. There was a couple positions from license. We now call it inspection and enforcement. Our research and evaluation department at that time was decimated. The Juvenile Services Division was eliminated. We took cuts in finance, HR, employee development, IT. The Facilities Division took some cuts in the Fugitive Unit, education, and a couple program areas.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm going to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Chris to talk about the impacts of some of these budget cuts.
Thank you. Welcome, Assistant Commissioner Chris.
Madam Chair, my name is David Christ. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Facilities Division. One of the things that impacted us deeply in the facilities was the increased double bunking, particularly at Stillwater. We took a cell block at Stillwater that would normally hold 252 offenders, and we attempted, and we did at one point, we brought the population in that cell block up to around 450 offenders. We found that the increase of offenders in that living unit led to many incidents of violence, assaults, on staff, assaults on offenders, disobeying direct orders, and led to the necessity to lock that cell block up quite frequently during the initial portions of double bunking in that area. As a result of the increase of violence and the tenuous control that we had in that cell block, we eventually reduced the double bunking in that unit to about 360 offenders, where we hover in that neighborhood right now.
Okay, Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, do you have any incident reports or anything that indicates to us where these incidents occurred?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I'm speaking just with respect to cell block B West at Stillwater Prison. So all of the incidents I'm speaking of happened in that living unit.
Senator Foley, if you'll look at the agenda item number four, we did ask for more information that you had requested at the last meeting about assaults and that kind of thing. So I suspect that somebody will tell us more about that as we go along today.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was just interested in, because they stated that there were a number of incidents, but not how many and what locations.
Okay. Can you give us a little more detail on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, we do have a chart on that that I can make available to you. I don't have it at the desk here with me, but we can get that to you.
Okay, that would be good.
Yep.
Continue, please.
Madam Chair, some of the other operational cuts and how this is impacting us is they've eroded our base budget. As most of you know, we are managing a $10 million deficit this year because there are requests we've made in the past few sessions that have not been fully funded, specifically in the area of staff salaries. We were able to get money, a majority of the money we needed for the facility division last year, or I should say last budget session, and we were not able to get community service money that we needed or for operations support. So as we look forward, you know, it's important that we try to maintain our base and get the funding we need for the operations of the facilities. Our current biennial budget, as you know, has an operational deficiency request for funding. That is to cover 194 positions that we currently have working in our agency already.
Working in? I didn't hear you.
They work for our agency currently. Oh. It's our current operations. And if there aren't any questions on the funding issues and the budget cuts, we would like to move on to the central office staffing.
Okay, Senator Berglund has a question.
Madam Chair, my question has to do with the number of people incarcerated in our Minnesota prisons that are not legal citizens. Do we know the number?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, we do not have that information with us. We would be happy to get it to you.
I'm not only interested in that number, I'm interested in what is being done to make sure they don't have to stay in a Minnesota prison at taxpayers' expense when, you know, typically if they have committed an offense that would cause them to be in prison, they will be deported at the end of their sentence. So what are we doing to try to speed that up?
It would be a good thing to know. I think the whole committee would like that information. Madam Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, may I ask that when you do the looking at the data, can you disaggregate between those who are legal permanent residents, not U.S. citizens, but legal resident permanents, permanent residents, and then the ones who are, and then those who are undocumented?
Madam Chair, we will get you that information.
Thank you. Other questions before we go on? Okay, proceed, please.
There were also questions about our staffing levels at central office and wondering if there's been increases since the year 2000. Or you said 10 to 12 years. We were able to go back to 2000.
Okay.
Our central office has employees in it from all three divisions of the agency, the facilities division, community services, and operations support. The facilities division has people from the Office of Special Investigation, centralized transportation, health services, reentry, MnCorps, and education. Community Services has staff for risk assessment, community notification, the Interstate Compact, inspection and enforcement, the grant and subsidy, and Community Service Administration. The Operations Support Division, which I will provide you more detail on, has the Commissioner's Office, Finance, Human Resources, Information Technology, Employee Development, Policy and Legal Services, and Office Services. Currently, we have a total of 314 employees in Central Office. Back in 2000, there were 46 less people. As you know, in the middle of that time frame, 80 positions went away. And so we do have more positions than we did in 2004, let's say. However, we just have 46 more than from the year 2000. Our business is not static. It changes. So some of the positions that were eliminated in those budget cuts were not reinstated. Some of the positions that have been created are quite different. We have more staff in risk assessment and community notification. We have more staff in IT. We have more staff in hearings and release and records. And a lot of that is due to our increased offender population. Since 2000, we've increased over 3,000 offenders. We also had to increase our central transportation unit. We have a lot of additional offenders that have to move around the state. We had to bring staff into central office to monitor our contract at Prairie Correctional Facility and also to help manage those offenders that aren't housed in our prisons.
So, Commissioner Cornelius, are there things in the central office that you don't do that you were doing before the cuts in 2000?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct. We no longer have the Jail Resource Center. We no longer have the Female Offender Planning Unit. Our Restorative Justice Unit is no longer a unit. It's a body that does it part-time. So there are definitely things that we are not doing anymore. We've had to change our business and how we operate with the times and use what's best practice. And I wanted to let you know, for operations support, this division provides services for the entire agency. And we did provide you a list of all the staffing and classifications for each unit. And one thing I do want to point out is, out of those 258 staff that are in that division, 46% of them, which is 119 people, actually work in the prisons and provide direct service there. And I just want to talk a little bit about what each of these divisions does. The Commissioner's Office, which is the Operations Support Services, she's responsible for the day-to-day operations of the entire agency, the prisons, probation, supervised release administration, administration of the CCA counties and the CPO, the Communications Office, and government relations. Her office responds to all media requests, to all legislative requests. We actually get about probably 10 to 15 media contacts a week, and although that may not sound like a lot, some of them take an extraordinary amount of time to respond to. We also have continuous improvement, which is a fairly new initiative for our agency, which we're very excited about. We've trained about 150 staff in various continuous improvement techniques, and it's proving to be very fruitful for us. An example is we recently did an event on victim notification, and we reduced the time for victims to get notified from 30 days to one. And so we're very pleased about that. We have right now completed 23 different process improvement projects. We have 11 more scheduled for this year, and we are finding staff are quite excited about this, as are we. In Policy and Legal Services, we have the Hearings and Release Unit, Litigation Management, the Board of Pardons, Data Practices, Records, Sentence Administration. They also manage tort, property, and offender injury claims, policy, and accreditation. They review contracts and provide investigations for anti-discrimination and sexual harassment claims. I just want to highlight some of the duties.
Just a second, please. Commissioner Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back just a short here, you said victim notification. You cut down from 10 to 1 day or 30 to 1 day?
Madam Chair, Senator, actually from 30 to 1.
That's victim notification. Are you using the VINE system there? How is that?
Madam Chair and Senator, I'm going to let Mr. Chris speak up a little bit about this one.
Commissioner Chris.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, the statutes allow victims of crimes to contact the Department of Corrections and enter a request that they be notified when offenders are released from prison or transferred from one custody level to a lesser custody level. One of the initiatives as part of this process improvement event was to acknowledge the receipt of that request from victims, where it used to take us 30 days to just let the victims know we got your letter. We're down to one day or same day response back to the victims. Where it's not through the VINE system per se. It's our manual process of shuffling the paper that we improve to be more responsive to victims.
Thank you.
Continue, please.
Madam Chair, I do want to highlight some work that these divisions do because I think it's important to realize that this is not an all-inclusive look. It's a snapshot at some of the key things they do and some of the numbers that we process. In Policy and Legal Services, specifically the Records Unit, they are responsible for administration of over 27,000 offender sentences. They manage over 14,000 offender felony files. They identify and file over 123,000 new documents every year. They respond to over 10,000 requests for information. They close and archive almost 13,000 offender felony and probation files. They manage over 8,000 open or active felony cases, including over 15,000 sentences. In the Hearings and Release Unit, in 2007, they issued 4,200 warrants, which was an increase of 57% since the year 2000. They had over 2,000 offender restructures to release conditions, up 44% from 2000. And they had over 2,500 revocation hearings, which is an increase of 42% since the year 2000. The Finance Division is responsible for the biennial capital budgets, accounts payable, accounts receivable, staff payroll, offender banking and payroll, internal auditing, annual spending plans, financial reporting, grant financial management, financial analysis, and fiscal notes. This is a total of 75 people, 59 of them work in the prisons. They're responsible to review, approve, and enter over 6,600 budget transactions for 1,700 budget orgs. They receive and process over 46,000 accounts receivable and deposit transactions. They review and approve and enter over 360,000 employee payroll and expense transactions. They audit for authorization and enter over 310,000 offender banking transactions. They process all pass-through dollars to CCA and CPO. Last year, we completed over 102 fiscal notes. And they audit and file all the documentation for the above-mentioned transactions. And again, this is not all-inclusive, of course, of what they do, but I just want to highlight some areas. They also provide financial services for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We have our offices services unit, which is 8 people. They provide the reception, mailroom, fleet management, and building lease for central office. Our human resource division, which is 46.5 people, provide the staffing, hiring, criminal history checks, labor relation, worker compensation, staffing analysis, recruitment, diversity, job classification, and compensation. Of these 46.5 staff, 23 of them work in the facilities. In 2008, they filled 673 vacancies. That includes hires, promotions, rehires, or transfers. They hired or rehired 366 new employees, of which 205 were correctional officers. Over 3,200 people applied for correctional officer jobs, so they managed those applications, and they tested 639 people for correctional officer positions. With our union contracts, we have to post a lot of our positions, especially with correctional officer movement throughout the facilities. They posted and filled 925 vacancies last year. They conducted 158 job audits, processed over 20,000 employee transactions, managed over 200 worker comp claims, managed over 500 FMLA leaves. They administer 7 different bargaining contracts and 2 plans. And they also provide services for sentencing guidelines.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ma'am, I was trying to know what you're looking at as far as the turnover in your correctional staff. I've been advised that there was a fair amount of turnover there, and that there was a training and persons left after they got properly trained and so forth. Is that anything that you can document?
Commissioner Cornelius?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, our turnover recently has actually declined fairly substantially, and I think that might be due to economic reasons. We have in the past, knowing that we often get people that come into our system and we train them through the academy, and then they will go work perhaps at a county jail where they may make more money. We've seen that dissipate a bit in recent months, though.
Thank you.
You operate an academy?
Madam Chair, yes, we do, and that was my next bullet point,
actually.
That's your
next bullet point, okay. right on target, aren't I?
Yes. Our employee development unit does provide a training academy for new staff. They also do ongoing skills building, management development, curriculum development. We do train the trainer. We develop e-learning programs. They develop our annual training plans and organizational development. This is a total of 7 staff. I'll just give you a little more information. Our training academy, new officers and all new staff actually come to central office for an orientation to get to know about the agency. They provide direct contact staff with more training. They talk about how to work with inmates, bloodborne pathogens, right to know. It's all the stuff about working in a prison that you need to know. Last year, we provided over 33,000 hours of trainings just for new officers. And interestingly, we learned our academy is 2 weeks at central office, and it's 4 weeks at the facility with field training. We just learned last week that the state of Wisconsin actually has a 7-week training academy at a specific site. So I thought that was interesting because we've done a lot to revamp ours. Our training department also last year developed 25 new online programmings, which allows staff. We had over 73,000 hours of training just online with staff last year. We also provide this training to over 100 state, county, and local entities so they can access our online programs. We also provide evidence-based practices training to agents in CCA and CPO counties to include motivational interviewing, the risk inventory tools that are used, and other things. We provide that for them. We use train-the-trainer programs in order to save money. It's a lot. It costs a lot to hire people to do CPR training or to do first aid training, and a lot of these things that are necessary and required either through ACA or OSHA or other entities, we do our own train-the-trainer, so we have certified trainers in our facilities and at our central office. Our information technology unit is responsible for programming our systems, technical support, technology planning, research and evaluation, CRIMNET, the statewide supervision system, application testing and support, prison population projections, and data requests. There's a total of 72 employees, 33 and a half which work in our prisons. They support over 4,000 workstations and 150 servers for the agency. They support over 4,000 criminal justice staff and other agencies using critical systems such as the statewide supervision system, interstate compact system, sex offender tracking, and our training management system. They also update and maintain the Level 3 sex offender website. Last year, they received over 16,000 help desk requests. They develop and maintain over 20 systems essential to ensuring staff and public safety, including offender risk assessment, the Office of Special Investigations, case tracking and investigations, the sex offender community treatment tracking, statewide supervision, and controlled access tracking system. Last year, they completed over 95 change requests for those specialized applications. They responded to 125 data requests, and the research area has also developed, implemented, and reported research and evaluation projects such as CD treatment and the Challenge Incarceration Program, also sex offender recidivism. And finally, this unit also is responsible to prepare the prison population projections. We provided a list of all the staff in these units. And this is the area, too, where we have submitted a $1.1 million cut.
sorry, where is that on here?
That list, Madam Chair, should be in your packet, and it says Minnesota Department of Corrections classification listing by budget activity.
Okay, so you are prepared to make a million dollar.
It's a $1.1 million cut to this division.
All right. You said a little while ago that there's been a 42% increase in revocation hearings since 2000. Can you talk to us about that more? Is there an explanation why, other than we have more people out because we've been sending more people to prison?
Madam Chair, I probably can't give the specific reasons. I do know a big portion of that is the increase of 3,000 offenders during that time frame. You know, we had 6,000 and now we have 3,000. And I also believe that the level of offenders we are getting are tougher. If Mr. Christ has anything to add to that.
Commissioner Christ? Okay. Another question. Is programming at the institutions done by this group of people, or are they included in this group of people, or?
Madam Chair, the programming dependent on what the programming is not, none of it would be done by this group of people.
Okay.
The education program, and the chemical dependency and the sex offender programming is all in the adult institutions division.
Okay. Senator Ingbretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one question. You said you have seven different bargaining units throughout the system, through these employees here or the whole system?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingbretson, it's through our whole system, through the whole DOC.
Can you just for a point of information, tell me what levels or why you have seven?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingbretson, the nurses have a contract, the teachers have a contract, there's AFSCME, MAPE, MMA, I'm missing two of them.
Teamsters and SEI.
Law enforcement.
Yeah.
Well, we got the manager's plan, the commissioner's plan, but I'm still missing one contract. But we have a unit. Actually, Unit 8 and AFSCME is a separate one. That's probably not separate, but there's an offshoot of it. So that's probably the seventh.
Senator Pauley? Units there for bargaining purposes have been adopted a long time ago in regard to what Doer was putting in. So you have different things. I don't know whether they still use the same thing as in my day, but that's all something that's not the corrections department does. It's the administration, and the types of jobs they have are what brings them into
different
branches.
Sure. Okay. Makes sense. Other questions? All right, continue, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am going to turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Christ to talk about the agenda items regarding offender safety.
Okay. Commissioner Christ?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, I've been given that document I referred to earlier on the discipline offenses in B West, so maybe I'll just summarize that, and then we'll get a copy of that to the committee afterwards. But we started the double bunking in B West in March of 2004, and discipline infractions in that living unit in the first 6 months rose from around 30 a month to around 90 a month the first 6 months that we double bunked in that living unit. It dropped off after we did some lockups in that living unit to get the troublemakers out of there, to get the contraband out of there, to gain some control of that living unit. It took a drop. It increased slightly again from about 45 infractions a month to 70 a month when our population peaked in that living unit. And then there were a series of lockups that stretched through 2005 and 2006. On average, the monthly discipline infractions dropped to between 30 and 60 discipline infractions when we lowered the population in there to around 380 offenders. And there's been a steady up and down pattern in that living unit since then. So we'll get a copy of this document to the committee. One of the questions to us concerned the gang activity in the facilities. The good news about gangs in the Department of Corrections is that 71% of offenders in our department don't belong to gangs. Most of our correctional facilities find that we need to have about 10 to 15% of our prison beds in our segregation unit, because we've got that amount of regular troublemakers that in a facility of 1,000 inmates, we need to have about 150 beds in order to sanction the people that are breaking the rules on a regular basis. As far as gangs go, we've got about 1,570 active or suspected active gang members out of our population of 9,200 offenders at any given time. They are active offenders if they meet 3 out of 10 criteria that law enforcement typically uses to identify gang members. Those might be self-admission or wearing the colors of a gang or associating with gang members, having gang materials in their cells. If they hit 3 out of those 10 criteria and we document that, they'll go on the active gang member list. If they've got 1 of those criteria, then we'll keep an eye on those guys. We'll put them on our suspected list, but we won't document them as being a gang member. There, like I said, there's about 1,570 people that are active or suspected gang members. If one of those gang members, active or suspected, doesn't have any other indicator that they're a gang member for a period of 3 years, we drop them down to an inactive status. And there are about 1,188 former suspected gang members in our facility. So if you add those together, we've got about 2,600 people locked up in our facilities that are active or have had some gang activity active in their past or suspected. Questions about that before I move on?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You don't have to run through them all, but how many different affiliations do you have in prison, gang affiliations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, roughly it is in the neighborhood of 50 to 70. There are 2 predominant gang affiliations, people and folks. They represent in different ways. They have different gang symbols. They're both criminal enterprises, but the affiliations line up either on one side or the other side. And they divide themselves into gangs that are, well, some commonly known ones would be gangster disciples or vice lords, Latin vice lords, Latin kings. There's Native American gangs, Native Foundation, the Native Mob, things like that. But then even within those divisions, there are different groupings or sects that are, there's many, many of them, and they are maybe have just a few members, but they're still identifiable.
Thank you.
Proceed, please.
Madam Chair, I'll talk for a minute about assaults by inmates in our facilities. We keep track of assaults in 4 categories that is in your packet there. Assault one inmate on another inmate, one inmate on another inmate causing harm, one inmate on another inmate using a weapon, one inmate on another inmate with a weapon causing harm. And the assaults on inmates can be, it's a little bit of a tricky one to define. If it's a what I would call a fair fight between two offenders that just seems to be sort of spontaneous, we would categorize that as a disorderly conduct, and we would charge it that way in our disciplinary codes in the facility. But if the event seems to be one offender who walks up to another offender for no particular reason and just starts wailing on them, that would be categorized as an assault in our facility. So reading across the years from 2003 to, or fiscal year 2003 to fiscal year 2008, you can see that the number of that kind of assault has increased from 284 a year to 550 a year. That takes into account both the increased population that Ms. Cornelius talked about and what we think is a more impulsive and dangerous inmate population. The assaults of one inmate on another inmate causing harm, though, has gone down from 86 in 03 to 65 in 08. The assault of inmates on another inmate with a weapon, that takes a pretty big drop on the sort of fist-to-fist kind of assault that we find in our facilities. Inmates, in my experience, working in the facilities for 30 years, I think they've got a vested interest in having a safe environment for themselves, and they are somewhat reluctant to raise the ante by going to weapons or going to weapons and causing harm. So in 2003, fiscal 03, we started out with 15 assaults on another inmate with a weapon, and that's gone up to about 27 in 08. Inmates assault on another inmate with a weapon causing harm. It started at 15, but it went down to 9 over that period of time.
Questions on that? Okay. Proceed, please.
Madam Chair, we were also asked for information about sexual violence between inmates in our facilities. And the document that is included in the packet not only reports offender-on-offender sexual misconduct, but also staff-on-offender sexual misconduct. These are statistics that we keep under the Federal Prisoner Rape Elimination Act. We report these statistics to the Bureau of Justice Statistics every year. And so we've got documentation from 2004 to, and I believe these are calendar years, 2004 to 2007. We divide each of the I'm going to get some definitions out here so I can be precise. We divide these into four categories. The first is offender-on-offender non-consensual sexual act, and the Bureau of Justice Statistics defines those as contact of any person without his or her consent, or of a person who is unable to consent or refuse, and that includes genital contact, penetration, and it's all non-consensual. So that's the first category. We divide our statistics into allegations, those that are substantiated, those that cannot be proven are unsubstantiated, those that are unfounded or, in essence, are disproven, and those where an investigation continues. In 2004, there were 13 allegations. That went up to 17 in 2007. These are offender-on-offender, non-consensual sexual acts. 2004, four of those allegations were substantiated, 6 were unsubstantiated, 2 were unfounded in 2004. In 2007, there were 17 allegations. None of them were substantiated. 7 were unsubstantiated, 9 were unfounded, and 1 investigation was ongoing. Then there are offender-on-offender abusive sexual contacts. That might be contact with any person without their consent, contact with the genitals, but it's typically through the clothing as opposed to skin-on-skin contact. In 2004, there was one of such an allegation. That one was unsubstantiated. In 2007, there were 9 of those allegations. 2 were substantiated, 3 were unsubstantiated, 3 were unfounded, and 1 investigation is ongoing there. In the staff areas, any staff on offender sexual contact is illegal under Minnesota statutes. It is a felony. And we take any allegations very seriously, whether it's sexual misconduct or sexual harassment staff toward offenders. So in 2007, I won't go through every year here, but in 2007, there were 7 allegations of staff and offender misconduct. None of them were substantiated. 2 were unsubstantiated. 5 were found to be unfounded. And that would be staff contact with offenders that included genital contact, threats of sexual acts, or occurrences of indecent exposure, invasion of privacy, or staff voyeurism for sexual gratification. Then sexual harassment by staff includes demeaning references to gender or derogatory comments about body or clothing, or profane or obscene language or gestures staff directed toward offenders. And you see that there have been no allegations of that since 2004.
Madam Chair, I thank you for that report. It's helpful to know those kinds of things and to realize that assaults like that do exist. And I'm very interested in creating a climate so that the correctional officers and other employees that are working inside the institution have got a safe place to work and to be, and so thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, we really have stepped up our efforts in this area in the last couple of years. We have done a lot more staff training in that area. We are implementing sexual assault response teams so that offenders who report sexual assaults are given a level of victim response that is commensurate with the victimization that they're reporting. We've got a helpline, an anonymous helpline, so that offenders can report that they've been victimized, or they can report victimization to another offender, a line that goes directly to our Office of Special Investigations. So we've taken a number of steps in this area to ensure a safe environment, both for offenders and for staff as well.
Thank you for doing that.
Madam Chair, do you consider you're at an optimal level in staffing at this point, or are you concerned about the safety of the individuals?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, we're concerned. I've got some information here on DWI inmates, but let me jump to what I was going to close with to respond to that question. We're trying to manage a $10 million shortfall in this fiscal year's budget. And we think we're going to break even with that, but it's coming with an awful lot of pain. We're holding, for instance, in facilities, we're holding about 100 positions open to meet that right now, and we're curtailing current expense spending where it's practical and possible to do that. And that's getting tougher to do. Future cuts or underfunding could result in layoffs of security or program staff beyond the positions that we're currently holding open. And that $10 million deficit rolls over into the next fiscal year. We've got to solve that this year and then continue to solve that into the next biennium. So some of the programs we talk about are sex offender and chemical dependency treatment, education and transitions programs, all of which are being shown under evidence-based and best practices to reduce recidivism. So if we have to curtail or eliminate those, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. Offenders that are idled then if there are program cuts will generate more rule violations and prison unrest, making the facilities increasingly unsafe for our staff and for other offenders. Without adequate funding, and there are going to be increases in areas like food, health care is going up, utility costs are going up. We had a record January, and we don't have the bills in from that yet, but we're not expecting good news on that. Fuel costs, without increases in current expense budgets, then we have to absorb those in our facility budgets. You can't not heat a facility. You can't not feed offenders, and so what we end up doing is holding more positions vacant or cutting more positions in order to take that money from staffing and put it over to the kinds of expenses that we just cannot avoid. Lack of programming can result in higher recidivism, especially those programs that are proving to reduce recidivism. Higher recidivism results in more crime. More crime results in less public safety and more admissions to prison ultimately. And consequently, the cycle comes back to increased costs of corrections. So we are concerned about the level of staffing that we've got in our facilities now. We're concerned what budget cuts might do to us in the future, and we see a cycle here that never seems to end.
Commissioner Christ, in 2003 and other times when we had budget deficits that cuts were necessary, did you cut programming and as well as staff, as well as all these things that you have just been telling us about? Did you do that same sort of moving money around to the places that you just plain can't not fund and moving, managing the money in the same sort of way? I mean, I think that our deficit, I just was reading something that the governor has said to some organization this morning, that he expects the deficit to be $6 to $7 billion by the March, the February forecast, which we're going to get in March. I just don't see how this division is going to not have a significant cut. I think all divisions will have a significant cut by the time we're done. So I'm hoping that you have some really sharp minds and thoughtful people working at what I suspect will be unpleasant to all involved in all areas of state government. I know the governor didn't ask you to cut as much as other departments did get cut.
But if the news that he gave today is any indication, I don't know that anybody will end up without an ugly cut. So I hope you're continuing to look at other ways that costs can be contained, brought down. If you have any great ideas, let us know.
Madam Chair, I agree. It would get ugly if there was a $6 to $7 billion shortfall. The practice of moving that money around, as I described, is not just something that we do in times of deficit. Our facilities are typically funded in the in about the 98% for salary area. This year we're funding salaries around 96%. And the lack of turnover that Assistant Commissioner Cornelius talked about is really hurting us. When I was the warden at Stillwater for 6.5 years from 2003 to 6.5 years. We could pretty much count on a historic vacancy rate in the area of 4.5%. Well, if you're funded at 98%, your vacancy rate is 4.5%, that's pretty comfortable. You can shift some of that salary money from the vacant positions over to things like food and fuel and utilities. But this year, the vacancy rates in our facilities, in some of our facilities, are less than 1%. People are not leaving corrections jobs for other kinds of jobs. It was typical that people would leave corrections jobs to get a job where they could get weekends off, where they didn't have to do shift work, where salaries were maybe higher. A lot of those jobs just aren't out there in the economy that we've got now. And our jobs are pretty secure, so people are hanging around. And that's good for us because we've got less turnover. We get more experienced staff in dealing with offenders. So that's the bright side of that dark cloud, but it does complicate budget matters.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I appreciate your comments. And although it really doesn't help the immediate crisis, and I honestly, Madam Chair, do not know where this division is going to find any money. I mean, it is truly bare bones, and I think you're doing all you possibly can to streamline without compromising the safety and the rights of the incarcerated. But are you looking at as a division into your energy costs? Is that something farther down the road that you can look into? I mean, do you have a longer vision about, energy? I mean, that is a big thing. I'm sure, as you mentioned, your energy costs are skyrocketing. Is that something you're giving attention to, and is there any federal stimulus money that could perhaps be directed that way? Because there will be some money coming in energy, and I'm not sure. I mean, there's a lot of questions here for future budget decisions, too, that we need to start thinking about.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we haven't gotten an inflationary increase for areas like fuel and utilities, food, and things like that for maybe 16 years, maybe longer than that. And so we have been looking at things like energy. In the 90s, we went through all of our facilities under a program that NSP, as it was known then, operated, where they funded the replacement of much of the lighting in our facilities, and we paid them back with the savings from those utilities. We're starting the second round of that sort of thing now in our facilities with Xcel Energy, trying to find new technology, smarter ways of lighting, for instance, that can save some dollars. So we're looking at that. But we do operate several facilities that are almost 100 years old, and there are just inherent energy inefficiencies in those facilities. You know, one thing that back in the 90s wasn't cost effective was to replace the windows, the 100-year-old single pane windows at Stillwater Prison, because the payback was around 30 years. At today's energy prices, that payback is getting down to where it might be smart to invest bonding money or capital investment into replacing windows in a real old facility like that that are thermal pane windows. So we're looking at those things.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, my other question is, are you able, I would assume I know the answer to this, but I just want it verified, to transfer money from one area of the budget to the other area, or do you pretty much have to keep it all within its designated spot?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we are able to transfer money within the division quite easily at the agency level with the approval of our executive budget officers. If we do transfer money between divisions, it typically is feasible. We route that through our executive budget officer, and then it goes to the chairs of the committee for approval.
Senator Brueggemann.
Madam Chair, I at least haven't noticed that your per prisoner per diem costs have gone down. If you're double bunking, I mean, it would seem to me that either there's inflation someplace in your budget, or your actual per inmate per diem costs would be going down.
Madam Chair, Senator Brueggemann, there are yes, there are added costs in our budget. We have got salary increases, and we have got funded for some of that money. So there are costs involved in that. As we get new offenders, too, there's a marginal per diem, and when we get funding for that, we have additional funding brought into our agency. Healthcare is one of those areas that has inflated quite substantially, so that does get added onto our per diem. So the costs are going up. We did double bunk some offenders, not to the level we thought we were going to, but at some point that gets saturated. I mean, the population of Stillwater is fairly stagnant. So as salary costs go up and money gets put into that, the offender population doesn't change. The per diem goes up.
Well, Madam Chair, my point here is that I think it's a little misleading to say you've never gotten inflation for 16 years in your budget.
So in the last few days or last couple of weeks, I've heard a lot of numbers being thrown around about what the actual cost per offender in the institution is these days. That per diem cost would be, and you said it's rising. So what is it for a year or per day these days?
Madam Chair, the final per diem last year averaged adult male per diem was a little over $89 per day.
$89 a day, which gives us, I do bad math. Mr. Turner has a calculator. Okay. And the Shakopee is higher or lower?
Madam,
$32,485. Okay.
Madam Chair, the Shakopee per diem is higher. I don't have that with me.
Significantly or a couple of dollars?
We will get that to you in a moment.
Okay.
Good. Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Never mind.
It was there, and
was
then you lost it.
I do have it, Madam
Chair.
Okay. Commissioner, how many are you expected to release this year from the prisons? Will be released. Do you know?
Commissioner, one of the commissioners?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, we don't have that number with us right now.
Okay. Madam Chair, I do know last year I think we estimated we released at least 6,000. You know, just over 6,000 offenders, and my guess is it'd probably be fairly similar to that this year as our population has stagnated a bit, and we expect that stagnation to continue over the next couple of years. I did find the female per diem, and this does include an average for our CIP female program up at our Togo facility, and that's $93.36. And the male per diem specifically is 89.50.
89.50. Okay. I know people were quite proud of the being able to feed somebody in the institutions for $3 and something a day. I can't imagine that you still are at that number.
Madam Chair, most of our facilities, we budget them for $3.29 a day. And I would say at least half of our facilities stay within that range. For the facilities that do not, they actually have to find that somewhere else in their budget. One thing we have done that we're very, very proud of is have developed a standardized menu for the facilities. So they have, the food service managers have a very small scope of items that they order. It's between, I think, 180 and 200 items. And it's approved by a dietitian, and they all work off the same menu pretty much at all the facilities. So that has helped us keep costs down and get some good prices.
Economies of scale, I think they call that.
Madam Chair, I would add, though, that we are getting more complaints from offenders about the quality of the food. And it's food is one of those things you don't want to mess with in a correctional facility. I remember in the 70s at Stillwater Prison when I was an officer there along with Mr. McShay in the audience, we saw a meal in the dining room. It happened to be turkey a la king that day, and you could take the plate and turn it upside down. The stuff would stick to the plate. It was so bad, and we had real concerns for our safety that day. There were so many complaints about the food that reverberated throughout that facility. We don't ever want to get back to that state of affairs.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, and then let's move on to the DWI thing.
Just one comment. We certainly don't want to get back to the cold mashed potato tort laws. So work real hard on that. Thanks.
I could tell stories about the first pumpkin pie I ever made, but we won't. About the DWI page, would you go into that, Ben?
Madam Chair, yes, ma'am. There was a question last week when we presented about two different numbers, 23 and 411. And those numbers are the answers to two different questions. And so there are, on July 1st of 2008, there were 663 DWI offenders in Minnesota prisons. 23 of those 663 had prior DWI convictions before their current admission to prison. They had no other criminal convictions, just 23 of the 663. But of the 663 DWI inmates in our prison on that date, 411 of them, their current active prison sentence was for DWI.
Okay.
And no other active prison sentences.
So if they had been found guilty of other felonies, they would have served those sentences previously. So this was the active ones, correct?
Madam Chair, yes, ma'am.
Okay.
They either would have been prior convictions in a different incarceration, or that time would have run out during the current incarceration, and all that was left was the current DWI offense.
And then the other couple of hundred to get to
The remaining 252 were serving the DWI prison sentence, but they also had non-DWI crimes for which they were serving time at the same time.
Okay.
Chair.
Senator Latz.
Commissioner, those would they be in prison for those non-DWI offenses if they had not committed the DWI that they were serving for?
Madam Chair, perhaps our research director has a better answer for that than I do.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Debbie Kirshner. I'm the Director of Information and Technology for the Department of Corrections. And those other 253 do have an active prison sentence, so there was enough in their criminal history to get them to prison regardless of the DWI.
Senator
Latz?
Are you saying that the DWI combined with whatever their criminal history score was caused them to get into the presumptive commit part of the sentencing guidelines grid, or it was a probation violation that caused them to be sent back to prison? They might not necessarily have gone to prison on that DWI alone.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have with me the information as to whether those individuals got to prison for a probation violation, but it was a felony level sentence that, with their prior history, resulted in a prison sentence. We can get that information for you and find out how many of those 253 were probation violators who were revoked to prison.
Senator Lass?
Madam Chair, ma'am, so are you saying the felony level sentence would have been for the DWI itself?
Ms. Kirshner?
Madam Chair, Senator, both sentences that are active prison sentences are felony level.
Okay. To get a felony DWI, then it's got to be the fourth in 10 years or the fifth on record. But in many cases, on the fourth in 10, they have the opportunity from the district court judge to serve workhouse time instead of going to state prison. It sounds like it's the combination of the other. And your average here, prior DWI, was 4.2. So it's quite possible that they're right on the 4 or 5 DWI range and not 15 of them. But in combination with the other non-DWI priors, it's probably kicked them into the prison time for the sentence instead of workhouse time. Does that sound right?
Ms. Kirshner?
Madam Chair, Senator, their prior history, including their prior DUIs, would have been enough. I think they typically have to have a custody point on the criminal history grid to get them there. But we can get that specific breakdown for you of how many of them started out as a probation sentence and then were revoked to prison and get that specific information for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Kirshner or either of the commissioners, everybody gets to be a commissioner in this. Because I can't keep track of the assistant and deputy and things. So you're all commissioners. On the sheet that you gave us, would you define person offense? What kinds of offenses are those? Commissioner Chris.
Madam Chair, members, typically personal offenses would be murder, rape, robbery, assaults, kidnapping. Very, very generically defined, that would be the definition there.
All right. Do you have any sense of how many of the DWI inmates are released each year? I think somebody told me before their average sentence, if you could actually do an average sentence, it's about 3.5 years.
Madam Chair, it is 57 months, the average sentence for DWI.
So it's like 4.5 years. 4 is 48. Yeah. Okay. All right. So, how many would be released in if there's such a thing as an average year?
Madam Chair, we can find out and let
okay.
you know.
And then also, if you have any information on recidivism for the DWI folks.
Madam Chair, yes, ma'am.
Okay.
We'll get that for you,
Senator Latz.
That 57-month average sentence. Would that mean that are you defining that as being released after 57 months, or they'd be released after 2/3 of the 57 months are served onto supervised release?
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe when we say served, we mean time in prison, so they would be serving 57 months in prison and then going on their SRD?
Yeah.
I'm getting nodded yes.
So that would be maybe a 6.5 or a 7-year commit. Mm-hmm. With a release after just about 5 years.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct. And I believe this has a lot to do with this group of people and their priors. You know, they're coming in with criminal histories. It's not just the DWI offenders for most of them. I think the number was 23 people that were solely DWI offenders.
Okay.
Senator Lantz?
Yeah, but the other part of the number here, the 411, is that the 62% are serving only their DWI sentence and not any other active sentence. I would assume that would mean no probation violation. Everything else they've done was completely done.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that's the governing offense. They could also be serving time for other offenses.
Okay, explain that. Governing offense, active offense. Help me out here.
We're going to bring Ms. Kirshner back to the table.
Ms. Kirshner, thanks for coming back.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, of the 663 that we had in prison, 411 only had a current active DUI sentence. However, they had other criminal history in their past. So they got there for an accumulation of their DUI history, but also their prior criminal history, which was non-DUI related. Of that 411, 23 had no other criminal history. They only have DUI in their past. And by governing offense, currently what we mean by governing offense is the one for which we have the longest responsibility for them. So that takes us to the latest out date. So if they have a DUI and a theft at the same time, like the 252 do, who have more than a DUI prison sentence that they're serving with us, the governing offense or the DUI offense is the offense for which we have the longest responsibility for them. So the theft offense, if they have one, might be being discharged next year, but the DUI is going to be another 4 years out. So that's what we mean by governing offense, the one for which we have the longest responsibility for them.
Senator Ingridson.
Maybe the question Senator Lantz is looking for here, of the 23 then that are going there just for DWI, what does the average sentence stay actually with the good behavior statute?
Sounds like that's a 57 month.
Is it 57?
The 23 minimum. People who have only DWIs and prior DWIs, their average sentence or their average time in the institution, it would be how long?
Madam Chair, Senator, we will have to get what the average sentence and then time served would be for the 23. We haven't, that average that was given to you was for all of the DUIs.
Okay.
It wasn't just for the 23.
Thank you.
Other questions on this? Senator Lass.
Do we know how many of those DWI offenders are receiving alcohol treatment while in custody?
Commissioner Crist?
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, we have about 85% to 90% of our offenders are assessed as DUI or otherwise are assessed as having chemical dependency needs. They're dependent or they're abusive. We are able to treat about 34% of those offenders given the resources that we've got within our department. Other offenders, if they hit their release date and they haven't been able to attend a primary treatment program in our facilities, are given some treatment component as a condition of their release going to the streets. So we can try to find out specifically how many of the DWI offenders are going into treatment while they are incarcerated. Okay. I don't have the exact number today.
Senator Krugel?
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner, so do you have any concern with the parts of the governor's budget that are going to eliminate eligibility for treatment for 113,000 people and substantially cut rates to chemical dependency programs such that they themselves admit some of these programs will not be able to continue?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I think it's in the best interest of public safety that we treat as many offenders who are chemically dependent as we possibly can. I'm unaware of the specifics of the governor's budget that limit treatment on the opportunities on the streets. At this point, the treatment resources that we've got in the Department of Corrections are going forward.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Berglund,
I can just tell you that if 113,000 people, most of whom most of whom are adults, are, if they lose their coverage, they're losing their way to pay for their chemical dependency treatment. And that's either going to mean there's more going in, or it's going to mean when they leave, they're not going to be able to fulfill that part of their release plan because there's no mechanism for them to get the treatment paid for. If I were you, I would be very concerned about that.
So, Commissioner, if somebody is released without having had the opportunity to get the treatment while in the institution, does the cost of that treatment then fall to DOC to pay for it, or do we assume they go on medical assistance and then Senator Berglund's division pays for it?
Madam Chair.
Which then feeds into that problem that she was just telling us about.
I'm going to defer to Ms. Larson.
Hey, Ms. Larson, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the Department of Corrections. When somebody is released from us and they have not had an opportunity to get through treatment, we will do our darndest to provide them with a Rule 25 assessment to ensure that they can access then the chemical dependency or the consolidated treatment fund.
Senator Berglund?
Well, Madam Chair, obviously nobody in this room has heard me. There will be 113,000 fewer people eligible to receive treatment through the revolving treatment fund. So you can do your darndest, but they aren't going to get treatment if there's no way to pay for it.
Senator Ingressa.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm hearing a figure of 113,000. That doesn't pertain to the amount of prisoners we're talking about today, I don't think. You're talking statewide, is that right?
I'm talking about people that would be on a state health program. Many of these people, when they're released, go on to those state health programs, mm-hmm. either general assistance medical care, or if they don't fit there, then they try and get them on medical assistance.
And assuming that if the cuts are made to people who, and a lot of those folks are going to be already receiving that health care benefit and will be cut from the rolls, cut from eligibility, right? So it's not likely that new people, when they're coming out of the institution, would somehow magically get put at the top of the...
It's for people that would be currently enrolled in the program and for anybody who would have been eligible in the future.
Okay. Senator Ingridson?
Am I clear, Commissioner, that as soon as the prisoner hits the door, if they're on medical assistance, it stops. And now they become the responsibility of the Department of Corrections. Correct for everything?
Chair Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, sir.
Okay.
But the minute they hit the door going the other way, then they're eligible again.
Right.
Senator Lance?
Commissioner, do your projected bed needs reflect the cuts that Senator Berglund is talking about in terms of those who are currently eligible for treatment will not get it and will either commit a new qualifying DWI, causing them to go to prison, or will cause them to fail to fulfill their release plan and be returned either with a new violation or a new DWI?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator, our prison populations are based on current law the current status of those laws, and so no, that would not be the case, and that is an assumption we probably wouldn't take into consideration at this point because that law has not passed yet.
Chair.
You're the chair.
Mr. Chair.
It
seems to me if we're going to be honest about the budgetary needs of the Department of Corrections in the next biennium, you've got to factor in the pieces of the human services budget that's going to have an impact on your future bed needs and prison populations, and this sounds like one that's going to. I think you ought to factor it in and let us know what that projection would be. Maybe you can get that number to us as well, please.
Mr. Chair, I don't think at this point that our prison population projections have ever taken into account the state of human services budgeting. We do take into account court volume and the present laws and our Ms. Kirshner can maybe answer that question better, but I think it would be very difficult for us to find a way to project how those cuts would have an impact on criminality and people coming to prison.
Mr. Commissioner, it seems to me that there probably are numbers somewhere that deal with rates of offenses committed in connection with whether or not they get comprehensive chemical dependency treatment. And maybe Senator Foley's division will have to come up with some numbers based on Senator Berglund's division's projected cuts by the governor to see what's going to come through the court system so that you can make some projections for this division.
But
we got to work that through.
Mr. Chairman, I think the key to remember here is that you're talking about the governor, and they don't have any control over what the governor does. So I guess they probably wouldn't even feel safe to speak out, if you will.
Senator Berglund?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you might not be able to project how many, although you know there will be some, people entering prison because they don't get treatment. But you certainly know how many people you send out the door with treatment in the community as a basis of their condition of release would not be able to meet that condition of release and would likely be returned.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I understand your point.
And Mr. Chair, I would add, too, that we do update our prison population projections every year. So if there were changes in crime rates due to this type of thing, it would be taken into consideration.
Commissioner, could you get us some projection based on the number of people that are sent out the door with chemical dependency treatment as a condition of their release plan? And then the numbers that you might project that would no longer be eligible for treatment funding and would be coming back on a violation. If you can get the second portion of that as well, that'd be helpful.
Mr. Chair, we'll try.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Engelbrecht.
Yes, could I also ask the commissioner to include those that refuse treatment while they're in prison too, please, with those numbers. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, yes. Senator Engelbrecht.
Any further comments or questions on this topic? Commissioner, did you have anything further?
Mr. Chair, no.
Mr. Chair, we would like to thank the committee for this opportunity to provide this additional information, and we will get back to you with all your requests.
Thank you. Is there anything further to come before the committee today? At the end of the presentation by the department? All right, the committee is adjourned.